जय जय गौरचंद्र जय नित्यानंद जय द्वैत चंद्र जय गौर भक्तवृंद. Opening verse of the 20th chapter of the Antya Lila Chaitanya Charitamrita. So we have been chanting the name of the Lord, and now we're going to talk about chanting the name of the Lord in the beautiful stanzas of the Shikshashtakam, which we have been taking up. Many of you may have the pamphlet. I have an extra one here. Anybody needs one? There may be some more extras. Anybody likes, then we can follow along. So tonight we'll take up the second and maybe further verses. We've taken up the first verse yesterday and today, or this morning. Ready? Let's chant the second verse together. I'll chant half the line, and then you follow me, then we'll chant it all together afterwards. Nam nam kari bahudha nija sarva shakti. Nam nam kari bahudha nija sarva shakti. Tatrarvita niyamita smaranena kalaha. Tatrarvita niyamita smaranena kalaha. Etadrishi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi. Etadrishi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi. Durdaivam idrishamiha janinanuragaha. Durdaiva midrishami ha janina nuragaha. Now we'll chant it all together. Nam nam kari bahudha nija sarva shakti. Tatrarpita niyamita smaranena kalaha. Etadrishi tava kripa bhagavan mamapi. In the translation of Swami Prabhupada, various are thy names, O Lord. In each and every name thy power resides. No times are set, no rites are needful for chanting of thy name. So vast is thy mercy. How huge then is my wretchedness, who find in this empty life and heart no devotion to thy name. One of the fundamental concepts of Hinduism, going very much all the way back to the most ancient scripture of humanity, Rig Veda, we have this teaching, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Vadanti. This teaching is reflected again and again in the different traditions, and we find that, of course, Sri Ramakrishna emphasized it so much. We find here Sri Chaitanya Deva is also giving the same teaching. Various are thy names. So many different names. Nam Nam Akari Bahudha. And each name is invested with that power, the power to awaken us from ignorance. So let's go back to the Rig Veda once. We should remember this holy mantra. I wrote it down somewhere. Indram Mitram Varunam Agnima Hurato Divya Sasuparno Gurutman Ekam sad vipra bahudhavadantyagnin yamam matarishvanamahuhu. So it's part of a bigger verse. They call him Indra, Mitra, Varuna, Agni, or the heavenly sunbird Garutmat, The seers call in many ways that which is one. They speak of Agni, Yama, Matarishvan. The way Swami Vivekananda puts it is, that which exists is one. The sages call it by various names. This is such a wonderful teaching. And Sri Ramakrishna has specially come, it seems that this is part of his special message for the world today, which is so much needed. Everywhere we see still violence being committed in the name of religion. My religion is right and your religion is wrong, and that gives me the right to cut off your head. That's been going on for millennia, this misunderstanding. And even within Hinduism, the teaching has been forgotten at times. And Sri Ramakrishna used to poke fun at those people who would disparage other people who worship other gods. Though the Hindus would never go so far as to cut people's heads. But still, he would say, the Vaishnavas say, there is no one but Krishna to take us across the ocean of this world. Krishna is the helmsman to take us across the ocean. No one else can take us. And then the devotees of the Divine Mother will say, oh, we have no problem with that. Our Divine Mother is the Empress of the entire universe. She doesn't have time to bother about a ferry boat, so she employs that fellow Krishna for the purpose. So that way, especially between the Shaktas and the Vaishnavas, the devotees of Divine Mother and the devotees of Krishna, in Bengal at least, and I don't know about other parts of India, this was Sri Ramakrishna's own experience. They used to fight. They used to quarrel. He would poke fun at it. He would say, suppose there is a lake and a tank, in the terminology of Bengal, a tank full of water, and the villagers go to get their water from this tank, and the Muslims go to one side and they call it Pani, and the Hindus go to another ghat and they call it Jal, and the Christians go to a third ghat and they call it Aqua, and the Englishmen go, maybe there were no Englishmen in the village, but suppose there was one, and he came to a fourth ghat and called it water. And he would say, suppose now that they start arguing that they have different stuff. One has Jal and the other has Pani and the other has Aqua, and they get into a big quarrel. How ridiculous that would be. Everybody knows it's the same stuff that they're collecting, only they have different names for it. And this story, I'm amazed to find, when I talk about to people in this country, Americans, mostly from Christian tradition, when I talk about this, I give, this is a wonderful parable to tell the people who maybe aren't familiar with our tradition so much, and they immediately take to it. They immediately appreciate it. Yes. How can the divine be, how can there be different gods? There's one true God, and his name is Krishna, and all other gods are wrong. How can it be? This parable makes it so wonderfully clear. The other parable which people really like a lot, which makes it so clear, is the blind man and the elephant. It makes it so clear. Do you know the story of the blind man and the elephant? Asmita? No? Where is Asmita? That's not Asmita. Who is that?
Asmita just went up.
She went up. This is a good story for the kids. Anyhow, we'll tell them later. There's an elephant. There's a group of blind men. They're all friends, and they heard about an elephant, but they've never seen one. After all, they don't have their eyes are blind, so they can't actually see an elephant. But how do blind people see?
By touch.
Okay, so it turns out that there's a wedding procession in the village, and no wedding procession worth its salt will be without an elephant. So sure enough, there's an elephant at the front of the procession. And the blind man, hearing about it, show us the elephant, show us the elephant. So someone takes them to the elephant. And they come up and they touch the elephant. And afterwards, they feel satisfied. They know what an elephant is, and they start discussing amongst themselves, how about that? I never realized, says one, I never thought that elephant is actually like a big pillar. And another one says, what? I touched the elephant. What are you talking about? I touched the elephant. I found the elephant is like a big snake. And the third blind man says, what? You guys are both crazy. I was there. I touched the elephant. What's wrong with you? I touched the elephant. It's like a big fan, a winnowing fan. And the fourth one said, I can't understand this. You guys are all crazy. I touched the elephant. It's like a broomstick, like a broom with a whisk at the end. And so gradually they got into a big quarrel about what is the elephant like. I know it's definitely like this. I know it's like a wall. It's like a pillar. It's like a broom. It's like a snake. Somebody who could see, he came by there. Well, what are you all quarreling about? Hearing about it, he understood the problem. He said, you people, you have all seen, you have all touched the elephant, but you've only touched a part of it. The one who thought it was like a pillar has touched the leg. An elephant is definitely like a pillar when you touch the leg. An elephant is definitely like a winnowing fan when you touch the ear. Elephant is definitely like a big serpent if you touch the trunk. Elephant is definitely like a broom if you touch the tail. Definitely like a big wall if you touch the side. They were all right. And they've all had the wonderful thing is they've all had the direct experience of the elephant. They have experienced it, but they haven't experienced it in its entirety. So like that, people have had an experience of the divine in their religions. I have had an experience of the divine as Allah. So God is Allah. How can God be anything else? God must be only Allah. That's where the mistake lies. And this parable makes it so clear. And this parable is not unique to Hinduism. It's found also, and possibly originally in Jainism, not sure. But I told this story at an interfaith meeting hosted at a Buddhist temple. And after I told the parable, one of the Buddhist monks said, we also have that story. So it's a story common to all the Indian traditions, at least Jainism, Buddhism, and Hinduism. And this story is a wonderful story also to use to explain to people who may not, they may have some, most people nowadays in this country also have some kind of sense that it can't be that one religion is right and all other religions are wrong. This makes it so wonderfully clear. But of course, and in the context of our holy name retreat, the parable of the lake and the ghats is especially pertinent because it's the same stuff people are taking, but they're giving it different names. And Swami Vivekananda has elaborated it just a little bit, that when the Hindus go to take the water, they put it in a big earthen vessel. When the Muslims go to take the water, they take it in a leather bag. And when the Christians go to take the water, what do they take? They bring it in a glass pitcher. And the water takes the form of the vessel. The water is formless, and it takes the form of the vessel. How beautiful. The divine, infinite, formless, divine reality takes the form of the mind in which we try to understand it. So the one who calls that divine reality by Krishna understands that God is named Krishna and is playing a flute. And the one who calls God Jesus understands that God takes the form of Jesus hanging on the cross, maybe, or preferably standing on the banks of the River Jordan blessing the devotees. The one who worships thinks of God as Brahman, feels that God is the infinite divine reality beyond all mind and speech, beyond all forms and names. So it's a vibrant parable for understanding that all names are different expressions of the one nameless reality beyond all names and forms. And we can talk a little bit about the power. We talked about that this morning also, the power of the name. What is that power? Sri Ramakrishna says the power is, there's great power in the seed of God's name. He likens it to a seed. And a seed, when it sprouts, is very soft. You know how a little sprout comes out of the seed and it's so soft. Yet, we also know that that same little sprout can break apart hardest rocks and hardest soil, growing very slowly. It says, a seed is tender and the sprout soft. Still, it pierces the hard ground. The ground breaks and makes way for the sprout. I remember seeing on our morning walks in Trabuco, there's a paved road going down, and there are some little cracks in the road. And plants are sprouting in those cracks and pushing apart the pavement, the hard pavement. They're pushing it apart. Such is the power of the divine name to destroy ignorance. And what is ignorance? Our ignorance means we're taking the impermanent to be permanent. We're taking ourselves to be bodies. And we're taking God to be an idea. The divine name destroys that ignorance because it awakens the divine presence in us. We begin to sense the reality of the divine. And God begins to become real for us. We talked a little bit about this philosophy of Spotavada, the idea that the first manifestation of Brahman is nada, which then manifests as Om. And out of Om come all the divine names, and out of Om actually come all names, and out of from the names are further manifested the forms. Now, it's something interesting that about a word. According to this philosophical tradition, every word has four aspects, and the most external aspect is the one we're using right now, vaikari, which is heard. I'm speaking, and the words are entering your ears, and you're understanding something, and that way we're communicating. We communicate with words, but words have, this is only one quarter of the power of words, and actually, what's interesting, what's fascinating to me, is that the mantra first describing this division into four of words comes in the Rig Veda, in the 164th mandala, which is the verse right before our verse Ekam Sabhi Prabhudhavadanti. The verse right before this verse, which we just chanted, which is 164th mandala, 46th verse. The 45th verse goes like this. I'll try to chant it. Chatvari vak parimita padamitani vedur brahmano brahmana ye manishinaha Guhatrini nihita nengayanti turiyam vacho manushyavadanti. Speech is known by the wise knowers of the Vedas to be made up of four parts. Three of these lie unmanifested in the depths of one's being. It is only the fourth that people speak. So the other three are, first, a more subtle is madhyama. The middle, which I'm not really enough familiar with the philosophy to say exactly what is madhyama, but then comes pashyanti. Pashyanti is that pure meaning, divorced from the words. So it doesn't have the different words in different languages. On the level of vaikari, they're different. But when they get resolved to their pure meaning at pashyanti, which is that which is seen, the idea that the meaning is seen, the pure meaning of the word is on this level, a very subtle level. So when we take the name of God, we also understand it has first this vaikari level, this madhyama level, which is subtler, and then the pashyanti level, which is the meaning, which is God himself, God herself, the divine reality, that particular aspect perhaps of the divine reality which we are worshipping. Then there's a fourth aspect to every word. That is para, the supreme. Now, here, this is interesting. The para aspect of every word refers to Om, refers to Brahman. So, in fact, every word in this sense refers to Brahman. Every word. And the grammarians take grammar itself, the study of grammar, to be a path to the realization of Brahman, a path to the realization of the Absolute, because in every word is the power of Brahman, in every word. But on the other levels, of course, the meanings may be quite different. So the all the more the power of the holy words, the holy name, the name of God, because it surely, as every word does, refers to Brahman, but it has additional power because it refers on the other levels also to the divine. I think we can read a little quote from Swami Vivekananda about the mantra. About the mantra. Well, what I really wanted to talk about now is this idea of the power of the name, and yet, surely that power is available to all of us. But there is a special additional power which is transmitted from the teacher to the disciple in what's called initiation, mantra diksha. Many of us present have had mantra diksha, maybe most of us have had mantra diksha. And any discussion of the holy name and of the practice of repeating a mantra in spiritual life, we shouldn't omit to discuss also this idea of initiation. When the teacher, the guru, gives to the student the mantra. Now the mantra, of course, is the holy name, and it's connected with a particular aspect of the divine generally, the Ishta Devata, that particular aspect of the divine whom I worship. All names are names of the one divine reality. But there's one particular name which is most suited for me. There's one particular aspect of the divine which most appeals to my heart. So I'm going to reach the absolute beyond all names and forms through a particular name and a particular form. And we are encouraged to develop nishtha, single-pointed, single-minded devotion and concentration to one particular aspect of the divine. So the guru is one who gives us this mantra. And it is felt, yes, we can read the mantras in books, and that's good, and we can repeat the holy name, and it will surely have its effect. But something additional happens when we have initiation. It's like getting pulled into a stream. Because the spiritual traditions of the world, all the spiritual traditions of the world, are like rivers flowing to the ocean. Flowing to the ocean of the infinite divine reality. Now, when we take initiation, it's like stepping into the river. And the force of that river is the force of all the sadhana, all the spiritual practices of all the devotees, all the saints and all the sages who have practiced in that tradition. Which is why at least all ancient spiritual traditions present in the world today have this tradition of initiation in some form or other. The Sufis very much emphasize it. In Islam, Sufism, Sufi mysticism, mystical Islam, every Sufi seeker can trace his lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad. They know that my sheikh and my sheikh's sheikh and my sheikh's sheikh's sheikh, like that, going all the way back. And especially in the ordination of the Christian churches, the priests know that when they're ordained, they have the laying on of hands. The bishop lays his hand on the disciple. And they can trace that laying on of hands back to Jesus. So it's not that the power wanes over time. The power increases over time as the spiritual practices of all the saints, all the seekers, add, as it were, to that stream flowing to the divine. So that is how this power is transmitted along with the giving of the name. So it's an important thing to keep in mind. I was looking for a quote of Swami Vivekananda about this. Swami Vivekananda says, the names of sacred symbols are used in bhakti yoga. That's true. We can keep that in mind. The jnana yogi will not be taking the mantra of a form and meditating on a form of God. But here in bhakti yoga, we have a form of God to love. The names of sacred symbols are used in bhakti yoga. They have almost infinite power. Simply by repetition of these words, we can get anything we desire. We can come to perfection. Then he says, but two things are necessary. He gives some prerequisites. Quoting from the Katha Upanishad, he says, the teacher must be wonderful, so also the taught. So also the taught. So the teacher is important, but the disciple also has to be ready. The seed must be a living seed, but the ground must also be prepared to receive that seed. Such a name, says Swamiji, such a name must come from a person to whom it has descended through right succession. From master to disciple, the spiritual current has been coming from ancient times, bearing its power. The person from whom such a word comes is called a guru, and the person to whom it goes is called the shishya, the disciple. When the word has been received in the regular way, and when it has been repeated, much advance has been made in bhakti yoga. Simply by the repetition of that word will come even the highest state of bhakti. You memorized this one? Good. So, we call, of course, in our tradition, we call that Guru Parampara, from the Guru to the Guru. And in the Ramakrishna order, we are generally instructed to think in this way, that my Guru, whoever that may be, is a disciple of a great Swami, and that Swami is a disciple of another Swami. And that disciple, so we count back to Sri Ramakrishna himself. And we're still so close in time that I think many people here have received initiation from Swami Dayatmanandaji, Swami D as he is known, affectionately. And Swami D is a disciple of Swami Yatishwaranda. Swami Yatishwaranda was one of the very foremost disciples of Swami Brahmananda, the spiritual son of Sri Ramakrishna. Swami Brahmananda, of course, disciple of Sri Ramakrishna himself. So it's so close in time to this fantastic power unleashed by Sri Ramakrishna, flowing through his disciples to us, to our hearts. So we should feel very fortunate. We should feel very fortunate that we have come into this stream of Sri Ramakrishna, because it is at once so broad and yet so deep. And we're so close in time. Now, some people say, I was born too late. If only I had been born in the time of Sri Ramakrishna, then I really could have made some spiritual progress. He would have touched me, and by a touch I would have realized God, and all my problems are solved. Wouldn't that be nice? But how many people could recognize Sri Ramakrishna in his lifetime? Most people thought he was a madman. We would have been in the same boat. We weren't ready to recognize him. Now it's easy to recognize him. All his disciples wrote about him, his grand disciples. We see what an efflorescence, what a blossoming of spirituality is coming all over the world, and we can trace it to him. How Swami Vivekananda just strode across the platform of the world and just gave such a push to human civilization in a new direction. How could he do that except the power of Sri Ramakrishna? But at that time, Narendra was an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid. When Sri Ramakrishna said, the power that I see in Keshav Sen, I see manifest 16 times that in Narendra. Who would believe him? Even Narendra didn't believe him. He said, look at Keshav, he's such a great man, he's met the queen. Who am I? And yet now we see what a power has been unleashed. So now we can recognize Sri Ramakrishna. In those days, no one could recognize him. So we shouldn't feel like we were born too late. We were born at the right time. For us, we have come in touch with the children of Sri Ramakrishna, the children's children of Sri Ramakrishna, the children's children's children. And we too are children of Sri Ramakrishna. So that's wonderful. And Swami Vivekananda actually gives a translation of this verse that we just took up. He says, Thou hast so many names. Thou understandest what is meant by them. All these names are thine, and in each is thy infinite power. There is neither time nor place for repeating these names, for all times and places are holy. Thou art so easy, thou art so merciful. How unfortunate I am that I have no love for thee. That's the translation of this verse. We might find it strange. Chaitanya Deva was an embodiment of divine love, manifesting prema, the highest form of love, which only, it is said, the incarnations, the avatars, can experience that highest form of love. Ordinary people like us, body would be destroyed by that kind of love rushing in us. Still, if one drop would be enough for us. And yet, how is he doing, how is he saying like that? Of course, in one sense, they're teaching us how to pray. They're teaching us how to pray. How to pray for love. How do we pray? We pray for love. But also, it is such that we never have enough love. We get a little, if we get satisfied with our little bit of devotion, then we're in trouble. We should never get satisfied with that little drop. Say one day we feel, I love the Lord, and we feel a little devotion, and maybe even some tears come, and we think, Then we think, wow, I really have attained something, now I'm done. I wept for the Lord once. No, we need to go further. We need to go further. Sri Ramakrishna says, go forward. First of all, such is our egotism, that if we weep for the Lord, we hope that other people noticed also. So that people know what great devotees we are. Hmm? And then we feel like, well, that I really, now I've achieved something. That parable of the woodcutter. Hmm? I just need to say the woodcutter parable. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. That woodcutter was told, go forward. So we thought, what did the holy man mean? It means I should go forward? I go further into the forest. So he went deep into the forest and he found the sandalwood trees and he cut them down and he made lots of money and he was pretty satisfied. He was well-to-do. He no longer had to do the hard work of cutting wood all day. But one day he thought, hey, the holy man didn't tell me to stop any place. He just told me go forward. So he went deeper into the forest and he found a copper mine. This is why the holy man told me to go forward. There was more to find. So he mined the copper and he became really established. He was in no more problems. He became one of the wealthiest men in the town. Then he thought, the holy man didn't say stop at the copper mine. He told me go forward. So to cut the story short, because we all know it anyway, he found after that the mine of silver, and after that the mine of gold, after that the mine of diamonds. In spiritual life, it's like that. Just because we found one little pearl, we shouldn't think, we've got it. Keep going forward. There's whole beds full of gems at the bottom of the ocean. So handfuls of gold and gems. But that's why Swamiji said, translating with his little bit maybe his own personal translation of Uttishtata Jagrata Prapyata Varam Nibodhata, arise, awake, and stop not till the goal is reached. Stop not till the goal is reached. So we go forward. And how much do we love God? We love so many things. We love little devotion mixed in with it. That's good, no doubt. If we can get a taste of real devotion, then we feel that, oh, this is what I wanted. And then we want more of that. And other loves begin to taste insipid. So that's what Chaitanya Deva is giving us here. And when he chanted this with his disciples, he chanted this verse, and then all the disciples sitting around with him, they also began to weep, feeling that, yes, how much do we really love God? How much do we love that infinite source of all love? God is love. It's not just that God... In some traditions, they emphasize that God loves us, especially in Christian tradition. That's very much emphasized. And it's valuable. It's a valuable addition, which perhaps has been neglected a little in Hinduism. In Hinduism, we have always thought of, how much can I love God? But truth is that God also loves us, because God is love. And that's wonderful. What is love, actually? Love is the... is that which brings us to oneness. And the closer we feel to someone, the more we love them. The closer we feel to an object, the more we love that object. The closer we come to that one infinite reality, which is oneness itself, the more we feel love for everything as we begin to perceive that one reality in all. So love is the expression of Advaita. Love is the expression of that one infinite reality in the realm of duality. Swami Vivekananda says, wherever you see love, you see a manifestation of the divine. Where you see a cat loving its kittens, stand and pray. Stand and pray there. Worship there, because God is manifest right in front of you. When the eye of love opens, we see the divine, even in all forms of love. A mother loving her child, a cat loving its kittens, a miser loving his wealth. Everywhere we see a manifestation of the divine. Because actually all love is love for God. There is no love that is not love for God only. Mostly it's misdirected. Misdirected. We love so many things because we're searching for that fulfillment. We've talked about this already. We're searching for fulfillment. We're trying to fill that emptiness we feel. And we love. And so we love our money. We love our houses. We love our families. We love our children. It's all love for God, only we don't realize it. It's misdirected. So this path of bhakti, we learn to direct it to God and know that when we truly can love God, there's enough love left over for everything and everyone else. The greatest lovers of God are also the greatest lovers of humanity. It's not that if I love God, I'm going to have to hate everything else. That's a wrong understanding. That's the very immature bhakti, no? I love my God, I love my Krishna, and I hate all other forms of God, and I hate everybody else, because all love should be for Krishna. No, if I truly love Krishna, I see Krishna in all beings, and I love all beings. So this much on love for all. Let's see, where are we in our shlokas? He uses this term, this is also important, this term, iha jani, in this life here, na anuraga. This anuraga is the term for, you can say, extreme attachment. It's not just love, it's this extreme attachment. Now, that's really the nature of our spiritual practice, viraga and anuraga. To have viraga, reduce our attachment for all the other things and increase our attachment, anuraga, for God. Anuraga. Sri Ramakrishna emphasized this more than anything. If we can feel a little longing for God, that will push us forward. Otherwise, why should we practice anything? Why should we do anything? Because we do anything in this life because we want it. Huh? Why should we act if we don't want anything? The person who wants to become a great musician will practice hours and hours a day. And the greatest musicians, they do practice. They practice 10, 12, 14 hours a day. Why? Because they long to attain perfection in music. And along with that, maybe they long to get a little name and fame as a great musician. But more than that, it becomes a longing for perfection in music. The great scientists who discover those things, they spend days and days in the laboratory. They might go without sleep for several days running their experiments and all that. Why? Because they have a longing to know. They have a longing for knowledge, for understanding. So likewise, when true longing awakes, then we can spend all nights up chanting the name of God. That's the... So when we feel that little flicker of longing, we all have it to a certain extent, or we wouldn't be here tonight on a perfectly good Saturday night. There's lots of good things to do, but we've come here. Why? Because we do feel some longing. So that precious flame of longing is to be protected. To be protected from the worldly wind. You know, there's a lot of worldly wind. When you're starting a fire, a campfire in the windy place, you have to put some barriers around it to keep the wind from blowing out the little flames. And you stoke it. And once it's a roaring fire, well, then no wind can blow it out. So at this time we have to stoke it and fan the flames, And this is what we're doing by coming together. We're fanning the flames of bhakti, we're fanning the flames of longing by talking about it, by singing, by keeping holy company. So, shall we do the next verse? This next verse, Sri Chaitanya now gives some prescriptions, we can say, for the disciple, the qualifications of the disciple. What kind of character should we develop? And here, this is our Anushtub, the shloka meter, our well-known Gita, in the meter of the Gita. Trinadapi sudni chena,
Trinadapi sudni chena,
Tarorapi sahishnuna,
Tarorapi sahishnuna,
Amanina manadena,
Amanina manadena,
Kirtaniya sadaharihi,
Kirtaniya sadaharihi.
Now all together. Trinadapi suni chena, Tarorapi sahishnuna, Amanina manadena, Kirtaniya sadaharihi. You chant so well. Do you have chanting practice? Together you have chanting practice? No? Amazing, it's wonderful. You chant well, wonderful chanting. Okay, so Trinad api suni chena. Trina is what? A little blade of grass, huh? Trinad, then humbler than a blade of grass. Taror api sahishnuna. Taru is what? Is a tree. Like a tree, we have to be sahishnuna, forbearing. Patient and forbearing. Amanina manadena. This is a common and beautiful formulation. Amanina. Without praising ourselves, without giving glory to ourselves. Manadena, giving honor to all. Take no honor to thyself, give honor to all. And kirtaniya sadaharihi. Chant unceasingly the name of the Lord. Let's see if I have any notes about this particular verse. Well, the name has the power, but we need to be fit. We also need to recognize that there are certain characteristics. So here Chaitanya Deva is giving a prescription for our lives: humility, forbearance, giving honor to others and not oneself. See, Ramakrishna also emphasized humility. One thing he couldn't stand is a really egotistical person, someone who really had a big head, like all of us. No, we don't have such a big head. We have made some progress in spiritual life. But this, we have to overcome this ego, this I that says, I am more important than other people. Now, we all have that to a certain degree. I am more important than other people. I am a great person. I am that I that gets angry when we are insulted. If we are slighted a little and we get angry, that I. If someone else is chosen to be the leader of the group and we feel, why didn't I get chosen? That I. That I is the I that makes us feel separate from one another. That I makes us feel separate from God. That I, Sri Ramakrishna called?
Unripe.
The unripe I. The Kancha Ami. The unripe I, like a mango. Mm-hmm. Not a green mango. Hard and sour. Oh, sour. There's only a few crazy people in this world who like to eat those green mangoes. Everybody else will avoid them. So like that. So certain people in South India, no? You take a little salt and you eat a green mango and you love that sour taste.
Chili powder. Mm.
So add a little chili powder to it. But of course, I'm joking. Don't worry. But the hard and sour mango, how different is it when it turns soft? It becomes sweet and juicy. It's wonderful. So like that, Sri Ramakrishna said, he knows it's impossible for us to really get rid of this I sense. It doesn't go. This feeling of I am someone separate. I am me. I'm a separate person. That goes only in the highest spiritual realization. Otherwise, Sri Ramakrishna says, you cut down a tree and it comes an ashwatha tree, a banyan tree, you cut it down, next day it's growing up again. You can't kill it. But ripen it. Make it ripe. Let the rascal remain, he says. Let the rascal remain as a servant of God. So this is the ripe ego. I am a servant of God. I am a devotee of God. So we can consciously practice this of honoring other people and not taking honor to ourselves. And if we remember these teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, and water flows from a high mound, he says, it collects in a low place. In the storeroom, he gives this example of the storeroom in the house. And if you ask the master of the house for something from the storeroom, he said, oh, but there's already a man there. There's somebody there. So that somebody is the unripe ego. If there's an unripe ego sitting in the storehouse, you can't. The master won't go there. The master is the Lord, is the divine. As long as we're sitting in the storeroom, thinking I'm in charge here. God says, okay, that guy is in charge there. I need not come. But when that guy leaves the storeroom, then the master of the house has to come and sit there. Master of the house is the Lord. So Ramakrishna says, it is on account of the ego that one is not able to see God. In front of the door of God's mansion lies the stump of ego. One cannot enter the mansion without jumping over the stump. So we try to reduce this self. But we also have to remember, and I think this teaching of humility has been often misunderstood, especially by people in following the tradition of Chaitanya Deva. Sri Ramakrishna, the Vaishnavas would come to Sri Ramakrishna and he would say, You Vaishnavas are great people. You take the name of God so much. You chant so much of the holy name. And, for instance, one would say, oh, what do we know, sir? We are great sinners. Sri Ramakrishna didn't like that attitude at all. This attitude of having a low opinion of oneself. He didn't like that at all. Humility does not mean having a low opinion of oneself. Sri Ramakrishna would say, one who says all the time, I am a sinner, I am a sinner, becomes a sinner. What we think, that we will become. So humility does not mean having a low opinion of oneself. It means having no opinion of oneself. Just as pride means having a high opinion of oneself. And what would be the opposite of pride? Not humility, but some kind of unpride means having a low opinion of oneself. Humility is neither. It is having no opinion. We give honor to others, and we don't give honor to ourselves, but at the same time, we don't disparage ourselves. We don't say, I am a sinner, I am no one, I am worthless. This is actually harmful in spiritual life, to have a low opinion of oneself. Rather, Sri Ramakrishna would say, have faith. You have chanted the name of God. How can you be a sinner anymore? And he would try to break that attitude in the people who would come to him who had that attitude. What? What kind of faith do you have? You have chanted the name of God. You have chanted the name of the one who is all auspicious, all pure, who has all power to awaken you from the night of ignorance. And still you say you are a sinner? How can I be a sinner anymore? And then he would sing that song. I may have killed a Brahmin or even a child unborn, but I am not afraid because I have taken the name of Mother Durga. I will be saved. That's a wonderful song, though a little bit extreme. Right, it's a little extreme, but Sri Ramakrishna would sing that song. How does it go?
Ami Durga, 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 Bole Ma Jodi Mori. Akhere Edine Nataro Kamune Jana Jabego Shonkuri.
Yes. What is the...
Akhere
Edine. Anyhow, let it be. How can Tara stay away from me if I have taken the if I have sincerely taken Mother's name? How can Mother stay away? How can she stay away? I like the first line. The second line about killing the Brahmin and the killing the woman and killing the unborn child even. That's a little extreme, but such is the faith of the singer. It's a Ram Prasad song, no? Such is the faith of the singer that you take that kind of extreme position. How wonderful. So that is the idea that we should have. We practice humility and forbearance, but that doesn't mean having a low opinion. Now, about the tree, and Chaitanya Deva actually, see if I can find that quote. The beautiful... अनेक लोकेर वांचा अनेक प्रकार कृपाते करिलो अनेक नामेर प्रचार खाइते शुइते जथा तथा नाम लोय देश काल नियम नाही सर्व सिद्धि होय. Okay, so here this is kind of an explanation of the verse, the Sanskrit verse. First, of course, there are so many different ways to God. We've covered that. And then, of course, we forgot this part that no times are set. There's no special time. You can take the name of God at every time. Some people ask, well, shouldn't I have a bath before I repeat the name of God? Well, if you like, before your meditation, to help you feel more pure, you go into your shrine, certainly take the name of God. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't take the name of God at other times. There's no special rituals required, no special time, no special need. So vast is the mercy of God. We don't need to follow all these things. The name of God is for all.
Sarva shakti name dila kuriya vibhag amar durdeva name nahi anurag.
So, this is the previous verse. I've jumped back to the previous verse. Sorry, I got confused. Anyhow, that all the power is invested in all your names. And how unfortunate I am that I don't have devotion to you. Okay.
Uttam hansha apnake mane trinadham dvai prakare sahishnuta kore brikhasham brikha jano katile kichu na boloi shukaya maile kare pani na magoi.
Okay, the meaning is, did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
More or less. Here's where my limits of my Bengali are starting to be reached here. But see, what does he say? His forbearance is of two kinds, he says. Forbearance of two kinds. Now, when the tree is cut, we cut a tree for firewood, the tree doesn't say anything. So if it is injured, it doesn't say anything. And at the same time, if it dies shriveling up, it does not beg for water. It does not beg for water, it just remains quiet if it doesn't get water. And to anyone who asks, it gives what it has to give. What is that? Shade, protecting from heat, and protecting from rain, protecting others. So like that, not this is the highest practice of forbearance, not to complain when injured. Of course, the highest state is when we don't even recognize we have been injured. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes, and that's wonderful when that happens, when someone will tell us, oh, I'm so sorry, did you hear what that person said to you, how wrong it was? And you say, what? I didn't hear anything. We heard the words, but we didn't feel insulted. Someone else felt that we might feel insulted, but we didn't feel insulted. If that happens, then we realize, oh, we didn't feel, because we don't have this high pride, we don't feel insulted if something, someone says something nasty. So like that, and he goes on to say, so that Vaishnava is best, who is without pride, will honor jivas, knowing them to be abodes of Krishna. So this is how, this is the prescription for one who wants to make progress in spiritual life, taking the name of the Lord and practicing this titiksha, which is also one of the disciplines to just say, all right, I don't, nothing, because actually it's never going to be perfect. If we think that, well, everything should be perfect in my life, then I'm going to take up spiritual life, it's not going to happen. It's like wanting to take a bath in the ocean and thinking, well, boy, those waves are pretty big. Let me wait for a while. Let me sit on the beach and wait till the waves die down. Waves of life are not going to die down. We think, let me get my kids in school and then I'll have time for spiritual practice. No, there'll be something else. Mm-hmm. Let me just settle my retirement, get my 401k up to $1 million, then I'll do spiritual practice. No, to be sure, something else will come up. So we have to do it now. We have to do it now. So we practice forbearance. That has something to do with forbearance. We say, okay, there's going to be difficulties. I forbear them. And it becomes sweet when we take the name of the Lord. What's the time? I can't quite see the time. 8:20. So I've been talking for an hour already. I think I better stop. Any comments? Questions? So all your doubts are solved, huh?
But you can not take in India. Everybody said, I did this, I did it. I don't know about America, but in India, everybody said, I did this, I did that, I am the great person. You know.
That's true. We love to sing our own praises.
But in India, people will forget that. Million people.
Sure. That's natural. Everybody forgets. Then we remember again.
Oh,
Well, if you don't praise yourself, you won't get promotion in the office.
Oh, good. This is a good objection. Very good. That's right. And if you want a promotion, you have a job review, and you have to sing your praises, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if you say, oh no, I didn't do anything. It was all the Lord's work. I didn't do anything. The Lord was working through me. May I be a humble instrument of the Lord. They say, okay, I think we have to think about letting this guy go, huh? This worker, we should, let's transfer her to another department. Too much religious. That's a good question. That's a very good question. So what do you all do? Who are practicing and you get your job review, how do you handle that?
It's very tough.
Tough, huh?
Very tough.
Mm.
This is how I used to wonder. I put myself as a witness.
Mm.
So I try to assess myself just like how I would assess someone else.
Mm.
I would speak about myself as if I'm speaking about someone else.
Ah, nice. I was also thinking that would be the best way to develop the witness consciousness, to look on such a review as I'm talking about someone else. And naturally, if that's the, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. But we know in our heart of hearts, if we're practicing karma yoga correctly, then we offer our work to God and we try to feel like we're just the instruments in the hands of the Lord. Because not everyone will have that understanding, so we have to play along. We have to play along. All right, play along. But I also think that this practice of seeing, giving honor to others, and when it comes genuinely, not when it's flattery, no? Flattery is quickly recognized as such. And it doesn't take one far. But if we genuinely can honor others, if we can genuinely appreciate others, then people feel that. And in the work environment also, if we can genuinely give it a little respect to others. And how we can most easily do that is if we genuinely can love them. And that's the hardest thing to do sometimes because people are so contrary. In our families and in our work, and who, some people are hard to love. It's true, they seem to be hard to love. So the way we can genuinely love such people is as we get more love for God. And it goes both ways. As we get more love for God, we are more able to love all people, and as we're more able to love all people, we're more able to love God. And I think it's... we also, this idea that we recognize that prickly personality who is troubling us in someone else, and this prickly personality which sometimes gives us trouble, that's not really who we are. That's not really who they are. That idea of a witness is wonderful. Good. It's a nice point.
But in work, you don't have to tell, I did that, I did this, but there is a supervisor there who's looking all the time.
Supervisor ought to notice. But if everybody else is saying to the supervisor, hey, I did this, hey, I did that, mm-hmm. then we might get passed over for the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And we want the promotion.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a fine line. That's why Upanishad says, kshurasyadhara, no?
Mm-hmm.
Like the edge of a razor is the path.
Edge.
Razor's edge. How sharp is a razor's edge? That difficult is the path. So we have to walk very carefully. We have to walk very carefully.
In our daily lives, how do we remind ourselves to be humble? The thought of being humble, it's so difficult.
Yes. See, Swami Vivekananda said, I don't believe in humility, I believe in same-sightedness. And that is a kind of humility. Samadarshitva is the Sanskrit term. We look on all people with the same eye. That's amanina mana denacha. So we're not specially honoring this, but we're looking with the same eye on everyone.
I especially noticed this in Swami Damodaranandaji. Did you ever meet him?
Yes.
He is a wonderful Swami. He had built up, though he didn't start it, Swami Rudrananda started the center in Fiji, and he, I think he was the next Swami, and he threw his heart into building up that center. And he became a great soul. He became, in his presence, one really felt, but what one specially felt in his presence was that he considered you his equal. That was amazing. On the one hand, afterwards you think, wow, what a great man. And yet, talking with him, he was so friendly, and we were brahmacharins at that time, you know, in the white dress. Now, in India, at Belur Mutt, there's two classes of people, two classes of monks. The orange, the people in orange, and the people in white. And you definitely feel your place. You are at the very bottom of the ladder. There's the orange robes is up here, and the white robes is down here. No, you do feel that. And probably devotees, you also feel a little bit, you know. And the white, if the white robes feel like that, where are we, no? This sense of stratification is stronger in India. India has a very much of a stratified social system all the way through. Even in the monastery, we all know our place. We know who's senior to us and who's junior to us. And we know to whom we should make pranams. And we know who should be making pranams to us. And we keep track of all those things. So how much humble we are, I'm not sure. But Swami Damodaranji had that. And once, he would talk with us every day after arati, after the evening prayer. For 5 or 10 minutes, he would stand outside and he would stand there swinging his chadar around so that the mosquitoes biting his feet would, just like one of us, he would stand there and, so we'll meditate, now we'll go for meditation on the Lord and feel the bliss of thinking of Thakur. And like that, and just saying it, how the way he would say it, you would feel like, ah, I can also feel the Lord sitting here in my heart. And yet, but utterly frank and free and friendly with us. And one day I saw him, went to our revered President Maharaj, at that time was Swami Ranganathanandaji, and we all go and make pranams. And of course, we wouldn't go up and actually touch his feet because his health was very delicate, so there was a barrier, and we would make pranams from behind the barrier, and he would bless us, and now and then he'd throw candies and all of that. And one day, Swami Damodaranda went, he had been to Australia, to the opening of the center, and he was showing the pictures of that to President Maharaj. And he was a junior to President Maharaj, not much junior, but a little junior, and after all, the president is considered as the living representative of Sri Ramakrishna, so everyone shows him special respect. So he went, and he touched his feet, and then he started showing him the pictures, and he was talking with him, I felt, just as he talks with us, the brahmacharins. I felt that same, he was talking with him in such a friendly and matter-of-fact way, not with reverence and fear, but with respect, certainly. The same respect he was giving to us brahmacharins when he was speaking with us, that same respect and friendliness he was treating the president, the most revered president of the order. And I saw, this is what it means, samadarshitva. And I asked him about it later. I pointed it out. And he mumbled something like, yes, we try like that, or something, he said. We try to look on that same-sightedness. So humility, we must remember that it doesn't mean having a low opinion of oneself. It doesn't mean bowing and scraping. It really means this, samadarshitva, having same-sightedness for all, not putting ourselves higher than others. Doesn't mean putting ourselves lower than others. We hold on to the faith, I am the child of the Divine Mother, or I am the Spirit. I am the infinite spirit. So how could I be lower than anyone else? I am the infinite spirit. But how could I be higher also? Because everyone is a manifestation of that infinite spirit.